self-anointed authorities roam the country impressing juries with their freewheeling opinions. To make matters worse, popular television crime shows portrayed forensic investigators as brilliant sleuths able to solve complex crimes with infallible science. The famous ones could practically look at a bloodied corpse and within an hour or two name the killer. In real life, thousands of criminal defendants were convicted and put away by shaky theories about bloodstains, blood spatter, arson, bite marks, fabrics, glass breakage, scalp and pubic hair, boot prints, ballistics, and even fingerprints. Good defense lawyers challenged the credibility of these experts, but were rarely successful. Judges were often overwhelmed by the science and had little or no time to educate themselves. If a proffered witness had some training and seemed to know what he was talking about, he was allowed to testify. Over time, judges adopted the rationale that since a witness had been qualified as an expert in other trials in other states, then certainly he must be a genuine authority. Appellate courts got into the act by affirming convictions without seriously questioning the science behind the forensics and thus bolstering the reputations of the experts. As resumes grew thicker, the opinions grew to encompass even more theories of guilt. The more Paul Norwood testified, the smarter he became. 1 year before Quincy's trial in 1988, Norwood spent 24 hours in a bloodstain analysis seminar put on by a private company in Kentucky. He passed the course, was given a certificate to prove his knowledge, and added another field of expertise to his growing repertoire. He was soon impressing juries with his scientific knowledge of the many intricate ways blood is dispersed in a grisly crime. He specialized in blood, crime scene reconstruction, ballistics, and hair analysis. He advertised his services, networked with law enforcement and prosecutors, and even wrote a book on forensics. His reputation grew, and he was in demand. Over a 25-year career, Norwood testified in hundreds of criminal trials, always for the prosecution and always implicating the defendant, and always for a nice fee. Then DNA testing arrived and put a serious dent in his business. DNA testing not only changed the future of criminal investigations, it brought a fresh and devastating scrutiny to the junk science Norwood and his ilk had been peddling. In at least half of the DNA exonerations of innocent men and women, bad forensics have been the cornerstone of the prosecution's evidence. In 1 year, 2005, three of Norwood's convictions were invalidated when DNA testing exposed his faulty methods and testimony. His three victims had spent a combined 59 years in prison, one on death row. He retired under pressure after a single trial in 2006. On cross-examination, after giving his standard bloodstain analysis, he was discredited like never before. The defense lawyer painfully walked him through each of the prior year's three exonerations. The questioning was brilliant, brutal, and revealing. The defendant was found not guilty, the real killer was later identified, and Norwood called it quits. However, the damage was done. Quincy Miller had long since been convicted because of Norwood's analysis of the bloody flashlight, which, of course, he had never seen. His razor-sharp analysis of the case consisted of reviewing large color photos of the crime scene and the flashlight. He never touched the most crucial piece of evidence, but rather relied on photos of it. Undaunted by this, he testified with certainty that the specks of blood on the lens were backspatter from the shotgun blast that killed Keith Russo. The flashlight disappeared before the trial. Norwood refuses to discuss the case with me. I've written him twice. He responded once and said he would not talk about it, not even on the phone. He claims he's in bad health. The case was a long time ago, his memory is failing, and so on. Not that a conversation would be that productive. As of now, at least 7 of his convictions have been exposed as frauds, and he is regularly used as the poster boy for junk science gone awry. Death penalty lawyers attack regularly. He's even been sued. Bloggers excoriate him for the misery he created. Appellate judges detail his wretched career. An innocence group is trying to raise a fortune in funds to review all of his cases. But that kind of money is hard to find. If given an audience, I would ask him to repudiate his work and try to help Quincy, but so far, he has shown no sign of remorse. With or without Norwood, we have no choice but to hire our own forensic scientists, and the best ones are expensive. I'm in Savannah for a couple of days putting out fires. Vicky, Maisie, and I are in the conference room discussing forensics. On the table in front of us are 4 resumes, our final 4. All are top criminologists with impeccable credentials. We'll start with 2 and send them the case. The cheapest wants $15,000 for a review and consultation. The most expensive gets $30,000 and there's no negotiating. As innocence work has intensified over the past decade, these guys have become highly sought after by groups advocating for the wrongfully convicted. Our top man is Dr. Kyle Benderschmidt at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. He has taught for decades and has built one of the leading forensic science departments in the country. I've talked to other lawyers, and they rave about him. We try to keep $75,000 in a war chest to pay experts, private investigators, and lawyers when necessary. We don't like to pay lawyers, and over the years we have become quite convincing at begging sympathetic litigators to go pro bono. We have a loose network of them around the country, and some scientists will reduce their fees to help an innocent person, but that's rare. Benderschmidt's standard rate is $30,000. "Do we have it?" I ask Vicky. "Of course," she says with a smile, always the optimist. If we don't have it, she'll get on the phone and fire up some donors. "Then let's hire him," I say. Maisie agrees. We move on to the second expert. Maisie says, "Looks like you're off to another slow start on this one, Post. I mean, you've struck out with June Walker, Zeke Huffey, and Carrie Holland. So far, nobody wants to talk to you." As with any office, there is a fair amount of good-natured ribbing within Guardian. Vicky and Maisie get along well enough, though each gives the other a wide berth. When I'm in town, I become an easy target. If we didn't love each other, we would be throwing rocks. I laugh and say, "No kidding. And please remind me of the last case where we got off to a fast start." "We're a tortoise, not a rabbit," Vicky says, offering one of her favorites. I say, "Yep, it took us 3 years before we signed on. You want an exoneration in a month?" "Just show us some progress," Maisie says. "I haven't hit the charm button yet," I say. Maisie smiles along. "When are you going to Seabrook?" "Don't know. I'm putting it off as long as I can. No one there knows we're involved, and I'd like to stay in the shadows." "What's the level of fear?" Vicky asked. "Hard to say, but it's definitely a factor. If Russo got himself rubbed out by a drug gang, then those guys are still around. The killer is among them. When I show up, they'll probably know it."
"It sounds awfully risky, Post," Maisie says.
"It is, but there's risk in most of our cases, right? Our clients are in prison because someone else pulled the trigger. They're still out there, laughing because the cops nailed the wrong guy. The last thing they want is an innocence lawyer digging through the old case."
Just be careful,
Vicky says. It's obvious these two have worried at length behind my back. I'm always careful. Are you cooking tonight?
Sorry, bridge.
We haven't frozen pizza,
Maisie says. She dislikes cooking, and with four kids at home, she relies heavily on the frozen food section.
Is James around?
I ask. Maisie and her husband separated a few years back and attempted a divorce. It didn't work, but living together is not working either. She knows I truly care, and I'm not being nosy.
He comes and goes, spends some time with the kids.
I pray for you guys. I know you do, Post,
and we pray for you.
I don't keep food in my penthouse because it tends to rot from neglect. Since I can't squeeze a meal out of either of my colleagues, I work until after dark, then go for a long walk through the old section of town. Christmas is 2 weeks away, and the air is cool. I've been in Savannah for a dozen years, but don't really know the city. I'm away too much to enjoy its charm and history, and it's difficult to foster friendships with a nomadic lifestyle. But my first friend is at home and looking for company. Luther Hodges hired me out of seminary and enticed me to Savannah. He's retired now, and his wife died a few years ago. He lives in a small cottage owned by the diocese, 2 blocks from Chippewa Square. He's waiting on the porch, eager to get out of the house.
Hello, Padre, I say as we embrace.
Hello, my son,
he says piously. Our standard greetings.
You look thin, he says.
He worries about my lifestyle. Bad diet, little sleep, stress.
Well, you certainly don't, I reply. He pats his stomach and says,
I can't stay away from the ice cream.
I'm starving. Let's go. We're on the sidewalk, arm in arm, strolling. Whitaker Street. Luther is almost 80 now, and with each visit I notice he's moving a bit slower. He has a slight limp and needs a new knee, but says replacement parts are for geezers.
You just can't let the old man in,
is one of his favorite lines.
Where have you been? He asks.
The usual, here and there.
Tell me about the case, he says.
He is fascinated by my work and wants updates. He knows the names of Guardian's clients and follows any developments online. I talk about Quincy Miller and our typical slow start. He listens carefully and, as always, says little. How many of us have a true friend who loves what we do and is willing to listen for hours? I am blessed to have Luther Hodges. I hit the high points without revealing anything confidential and ask about his work. He spends hours each day writing letters to men and women behind bars. This is his ministry, and he's committed to it. He keeps meticulous records and copies of all correspondence. If you're on Luther's list, you get letters along with birthday and Christmas cards. If he had money, he would send it all to prisoners. There are 60 on his list at the moment. One died last week. A young man in Missouri hung himself, and Luther's voice breaks as he talks about it. The guy had mentioned suicide in a couple of letters, and Luther was concerned. He called the prison numerous times looking for help, but got nowhere. We descend to the Savannah River and walk the cobblestone street near the water. Our favorite little bistro is a seafood joint that's been here for decades. Luther took me to lunch there on my first visit. At the door, he says,
my treat.
He knows my financial situation.
If you insist,
I say. Chapter 11. VCU is a city campus and seems to occupy most of downtown Richmond. On a raw January afternoon, I make my way to the Department of Forensic Science on West Main Street. Kyle Benderschmidt has chaired the department for 2 decades and rules the place. His suite occupies an entire corner of the floor. A secretary offers coffee, and I never decline. Students come and go.
At exactly 3 p.m., the renowned criminologist appears and welcomes me with a smile. Dr. Binderschmidt is in his early 70s, lean and energetic, and still dresses like the old frat boy he was back in the day. Starched khakis, penny loafers, a button-down shirt. Though he is in demand as an expert, he still loves the classroom and teaches two courses each semester. He does not like courtrooms and tries to avoid testifying. He and I both know that if we get as far as a retrial in Quincy's case, it will be years away. Typically, he reviews a case, prepares his findings, offers his opinions, and moves on to the next one as the lawyers go about their business. I follow him into a small conference room. On the table is the stack of materials I sent him 3 weeks ago. Photos and diagrams of the crime scene, photos of the flashlight, the autopsy report, and the entire trial transcript, almost 1,200 pages. I wave at the paperwork and ask, "So, what do you think?" He smiles and shakes his head. "I've read everything, and I'm not sure how Mr. Miller got convicted. But then, this is not unusual. What really happened to the flashlight?" "There was a fire in the storage unit where the cops stored evidence. It was never found." "I know. I read that part, too. But what really happened?" "Don't know yet. We haven't investigated the fire and probably won't be able to. So, let's assume the fire was deliberate and somebody wanted the flashlight to disappear. There is no link to Miller without it. What do the police gain by destroying it and keeping it away from the jury?" I feel like I'm a witness getting peppered on cross-examination. "Good question," I say, and sip my coffee. "Since we're working with assumptions, then let's assume the police did not want a defense expert taking a close look at it." "But there was no defense expert," he says. "Of course not. It was an indigent defense case with a court-appointed lawyer. The judge refused to provide funds for an opposing expert. The cops probably anticipated this, but decided not to take a chance. They figured they could find a guy like Norwood who would be happy to analyze and speculate using only the photos." "I suppose that makes sense. We're just guessing here, Dr. Binderschmidt. It's all we can do at this point. And maybe those little specks of blood belong to someone else." "Precisely," he says with a smile, as if he's already figured out something. He takes an enlarged color photo of the 2-inch flashlight lens. "We've examined this with all sorts of image enhancers. Me and some of my colleagues, I'm not even sure these specks are human blood, or blood at all. If they're not blood, then what are they? It's impossible to tell. What is so troubling about this is that the flashlight was not recovered from the crime scene. We don't know where it came from or how the blood, if it's blood, made it to the surface of the lens. There is such a small sample to work with, it's impossible to determine anything. If it's backspatter, wouldn't the shotgun and even the killer be covered as well? More than likely. But we'll never know. Neither the shotgun nor the killer's clothing were recovered. But we know it was a shotgun because of the buckshot. Two blasts in such a confined area will produce an enormous amount of blood. I guess the photos prove that. What is surprising is that there were no bloody footprints made by the killer as he left." "There is no record of any." "Then I'd say the killer went to great lengths to avoid detection. No fingerprints, so he probably wore gloves. No shoe or boot prints, so he probably had some type of covering on the soles of his feet. Sounds like a pretty sophisticated killer." "It could have been a gang killing by a professional." "Well, that's your business. I can't go there." "Is it possible to fire a shotgun with one hand while holding the flashlight with the other?" I ask, though the answer is fairly obvious. "Highly unlikely. But it's a small flashlight with a 2-inch lens. It would be possible to hold the flashlight in one hand and use the same hand to steady the forestock of the shotgun. That's assuming you buy into the prosecution's theory. But I doubt seriously
that the flashlight was at the scene. But Norwood testified that this is blood on the flashlight and it is back spatter. Norwood was wrong again. He should be locked up himself. So your paths have crossed. Oh yes, twice. I've debunked two of his convictions, though both men are still in prison. Norwood was well known in the business back in his heyday, just one of many. Mercifully, he quit. But there are plenty of these guys still out there, still at it. It makes me sick. Bender Schmidt has been vociferous in his criticism of the one-week seminars in which police officers, investigators, anyone really with enough money for the tuition can be trained quickly, get a graduation certificate, and declare themselves experts. He continues, "It was grossly irresponsible for him to tell the jury that these specks are blood that came from Russo's body." He shakes his head in disbelief and disgust. "There is simply no scientific way to prove it." Norwood told the jury that back spatter cannot travel more than 48 inches through the air, a common belief back then. Therefore, the barrel was close to the victim. "Not so," says Bender Schmidt. "The distance blood travels varies greatly with each shooting, and for Norwood to be so precise was flat out wrong. There are just far too many variables involved here to give opinions." "So what's your opinion?" "That there is no scientific basis for what Norwood told the jury. That there is no way to know if the flashlight was even at the scene. That there is an even chance that these specks of blood are not even blood. Lots of opinions, Mr. Post. I'll dress them all up in beautiful language that leaves no doubt." He looks at his watch and says he needs to take a call. He asks if I mind. Of course not. While he's gone, I pull out some notes, some questions that I cannot answer. Neither can he, but I value his thoughts. I'm certainly paying for them. He returns in 15 minutes with a cup of coffee. "So what's bugging you?" I ask. "Forget the science, and let's do some speculating." "That's almost as much fun as science," he says, with a grin. "Question one. If the police planted the flashlight in the trunk of Miller's car, why didn't they go ahead and plant the shotgun too?" I've asked myself the same question 100 times. Maybe they were worried about proving he owned it. I'm sure it was not registered. Or maybe it would have been harder to plant in his trunk. The flashlight is much smaller and easier to simply place there. Fitzner, the sheriff, testified that he found it when he was searching the trunk. There were other cops at the scene. He listens intently and nods along. "That's plausible. It would have been easy to simply pull the flashlight out of a pocket and drop it in the trunk. Not so with a shotgun." He keeps nodding. "I can buy that. Next question. According to the snitch, Miller said he drove to the Gulf the next day and tossed the shotgun into the ocean. Why wouldn't he have tossed the flashlight too? Both were at the crime scene. Both had blood on them. It makes no sense not to dispose of both." I respond, "I have no answer to that, and it's a huge gap in the fiction the cops fed to the snitch." "And why the ocean, where the water is shallow and the tides rise and fall?" "It makes no sense," I say. "It does not." "Next question. Why use a shotgun? They make too much noise. The killer got lucky when no one heard the blasts." "Well, Carrie Holland said she heard something, but she's not credible. They used a shotgun because that's what a guy like Miller would have used, maybe. A pro would have used a pistol with a silencer. But they weren't framing a pro. They wanted Miller." "Agreed. Did Miller have a history of hunting?" "None whatsoever. Says he never hunted in his life." "Did he own guns?" "He says he kept 2 pistols in the house for protection. His wife testified that he owned a shotgun, but she's not credible either." "You're pretty good, Post." "Thanks. I've had some experience on the streets. So have you, Dr. Bender Schmidt. Now that you know the case, I'd like to hear your version of educated guessing. Put the science aside and tell me how this murder happened." He gets to his feet
and steps to a window for a long gaze. There's a brain at work here, Mr. Post. And that's why you're not likely to solve this crime short of a miracle. Diana Russo told a convincing story of the conflict between Miller and her husband. I suspect she exaggerated, but the jury believed her. She pointed to a black guy in a white town, and one with a motive at that. They, the conspirators, knew enough about crime scene evidence to use the flashlight as the link to Miller. The real killer left behind no traceable clues, which is remarkable and says a lot about his high level of planning. If he did make a mistake, the cops missed it or perhaps covered it up. After 22 years, it is indeed a cold case and one that looks impossible to solve. You won't find the killer, Mr. Post, but you might succeed in proving your client innocent. Is there a chance he's guilty? So, you have doubts? Always. The doubts keep me awake at night. He returns to his chair and takes a sip of coffee. I don't see it. Motive is weak. Sure, he may have hated his former lawyer, but blowing his head off is a sure ticket to death row. Miller had an alibi. There is nothing that links him to the crime scene. My best educated guess is that he didn't do it. That's good to hear, I reply with a smile. He is no bleeding heart and has testified for the prosecution more than the defense. He shoots straight and is not afraid to criticize another expert, even a colleague, when he disagrees. We spend a few minutes talking about other famous blood spatter cases, and it's soon time to leave. Thanks, doctor, I say as I gather my things. I know your time is valuable. You're paying for it, he says with a smile. Yep, $30,000. As I open the door, he says, one last thing, Mr. Post, and this is even farther from my expertise. But that situation down there could get sticky. None of my business, you know. But you'd better be careful. Thanks. Chapter 12. My travels take me to the next prison on my little checklist. It's called Tully Run, and it's hidden at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains in the western part of Virginia. This is my second visit here. Because of the internet, there are now hundreds of thousands of convicted sex offenders. For many reasons, they do not fare well in general prison populations. Most states are trying to segregate them into separate facilities. Virginia sends most of its to Tully Run. The man's name is Gerald Cook, white male, age 43, serving 20 years for molesting his two stepdaughters. Because I have so many other clients to choose from, I have always tried to avoid sex offenders. However, in this line of work, I've learned that some of them are actually innocent. In his younger days, Cook was a wild man, a hard-drinking redneck prone to brawling and chasing women. 9 years ago, he caught the wrong one and married her. They spent a few rough years together, taking turns moving in and out. Both had trouble keeping jobs, and money was always an issue. A week after his wife filed for divorce, Gerald won $100,000 in the Virginia State Lottery and tried to keep it quiet. She heard about it almost immediately, and her lawyers got excited. Gerald fled the area with his loot, and the divorce dragged on. To get his attention, and at least some of the money, she conspired with her daughters, then ages 11 and 14, to accuse him of sexual abuse, crimes that had never been mentioned. The girls signed sworn written statements detailing a pattern of rape and molestation. Gerald was arrested, thrown in jail with an exorbitant bond, and has never stopped claiming he is innocent. In Virginia, it is difficult to defend such charges. At his trial, both girls took the stand and, in wrenching testimony, described the horrible things their stepfather had allegedly done. Gerald countered with his own testimony, but being a hothead, made a poor witness. He was sentenced to 20 years, By the time he left for prison, his lottery winnings were long gone. Neither stepdaughter finished high school. The older has led a life of astonishing promiscuity, and at the age of 21 is in her second marriage. The younger has a child and works for minimum wage at a fast food restaurant. Their mother owns a beauty salon on the outskirts of Lynchburg and has a big mouth. Our investigator there has affidavits from two former clients who describe the woman constantly telling hilarious stories of framing Gerald with the bogus charges. We also have an affidavit from a former boyfriend with similar stories. She frightened him so bad, he moved out. Cook came to our attention 2 years ago with a letter from prison. We receive about 20 per week, and the backlog is frustrating. Vicky, Maisie, and I spend as much time as possible reading them and trying to weed out the ones we cannot help. The vast majority are from guilty inmates who have plenty of time to work on their claims of innocence and write long letters. I travel with a stack that I read when I should be sleeping. At Guardian, we have a policy of answering every letter. Cook's story sounded plausible, and I wrote back. We swapped a few letters, and he sent his trial transcript and file. We did a preliminary investigation and became convinced that he was probably telling the truth. I visited him a year ago and disliked him immediately. He confirmed what I had learned through our correspondence. He is obsessed with thoughts of revenge. His goal is to get out and either do bodily harm to his ex-wife and her daughters, or more likely, to frame them on drug charges and see them locked up. He dreams of one day visiting them in prison. I have tried to temper this by explaining that we have expectations of our clients once they are free, and that we will not be involved with anyone plotting retribution. Most of the inmates I visit in prison are subdued and thankful for the FaceTime. But again, Cook is belligerent. He sneers at me through the plexiglass, grabs the phone, and says, "What's taking so long, Post? You know I'm innocent. Now get me out of here." I smile and say, "Nice to see you, Gerald. How you doing?" "Don't give me that happy horseshit, Post. I want to know what you're doing out there while I'm stuck in here with a bunch of perverts. I've been fighting these fairies off for 7 years now, and I'm damn tired of it." Calmly, I say, "Gerald, perhaps we should start over with this session. You're already yelling at me, and I don't appreciate it. You're not paying me. I'm a volunteer. If you can't keep things pleasant, then I'll leave." He lowers his head and starts crying. I wait patiently as he tries to collect himself. He wipes both cheeks on his sleeves and doesn't make eye contact. "I'm so innocent, Post," he says, his voice cracking. "I believe that, or I wouldn't be here." "That bitch put those girls up to line, and all three are still laughing about it." "I believe that, Gerald. I really do. But getting you out will take a long time. There is simply no way to speed things along. As I told you before, it's fairly easy to convict an innocent man and virtually impossible to exonerate one." "This is so wrong, Post." I know. Here's my problem right now, Gerald. If you walked out tomorrow, I'm afraid you would do something really stupid. I've cautioned you many times about harboring thoughts of revenge, and if that's still on your mind, then I'm not getting involved."
"I won't kill her, Post, I promise. I won't do something stupid enough to get my ass thrown back into a place like this."
"But?"
"But what?"
"But what might you do, Gerald?"
"I think of something. She deserves to do some time after what she's done to me, Post. I can't just let it go."
"You have to let it go, Gerald. You have to go somewhere far away and forget about her."
"I can't do it, Post. I can't keep my mind off that lying bitch and her two daughters. I hate them with every bone in my body. Here I sit, an innocent man, and they're going about their lives laughing at me. Where's the justice?"
"Because I'm cautious out of necessity, I'm not yet his attorney. Though Guardian has spent almost $20,000 and 2 years investigating, we are not officially involved. He worried me from the beginning, and I've kept the escape hatch open. You still want revenge, don't you, Gerald? His lip quivers, and his eyes water again. He glares at me and nods yes. I'm sorry, Gerald, but I'm saying no. I will not represent you. He suddenly erupts in a fit of rage. You can't do that, Post! He screams into the phone, then flings it and lunges at the plexiglass partition. No! No, you can't do that, damn it! I'll die in here! He begins slapping the plexiglass. I'm startled and move back. You gotta help me, Post. You know I'm innocent. You can't just walk out of here and leave me to die. I'm innocent. I'm innocent, and you damn well know I'm innocent. The door behind me jerks open, and a guard steps in. Sit down, he yells at Gerald, who is pounding the plexiglass with his fists on the other side. The guard yells at him as the door behind him opens and another guard appears. He grabs Gerald and pushes him away from the partition. As I ease through the door to escape, he's screaming, I'm innocent, Post! I'm innocent! I can almost hear him as I drive away from Tully Run. 4 hours later, I enter the grounds of the North Carolina Correctional Institute for Women, NCCIW, in Raleigh. The parking lot is full, and as always, I grumble about the money spent on corrections in this country. It's a huge business, quite literally, a profit maker in some states, but certainly a big employer for any community lucky enough to get itself a prison. In the U.S., there are over 2 million people locked up, and it takes 1 million employees and $80 billion in tax dollars to take care of them. NCCIW should be closed, like all women's prisons. Very few women are criminals. Their mistakes are picking bad boyfriends. North Carolina sends its female death row inmates to NCCIW. There are 7 of them now, including our client, Shasta Briley. She was convicted of murdering her 3 children, about 20 miles from where she is now incarcerated. Hers is another sad story of a kid who never had a chance. She was a crack baby who was bounced from foster homes to orphanages to in-laws in the projects. She dropped out of school, had a baby, lived with an aunt, worked here and there for minimum wages, had another baby, became an addict. After her 3rd child was born, she got a break and found a room in a homeless shelter where a counselor helped her get clean. A man from a church gave her a job and sort of adopted her and the kids, and she moved into a small rental duplex. Every day was a struggle, though, and she was arrested for bad checks. She sold her body for cash and then began selling drugs. Her life was a nightmare. Thus, she was easy to convict. 8 years ago, her duplex caught on fire in the middle of the night. She escaped through a window with cuts and burns and ran around the outside of the house screaming as neighbors rushed to help. Her 3 daughters perished in the fire. The community rallied around her after the tragedy. The funeral was gut-wrenching and made the local news. Then the state arson investigator came to town. When he mentioned the word arson, all sympathy for Shasta vanished. At her trial, the state proved that she had been busy buying insurance in the months before the fire, 3 policies of $10,000 for the life of each child, and a $10,000 policy on the contents of her duplex. A relative testified that Shasta had offered to sell her, the children, for $1,000 each. The arson expert was clear with his opinions. Shasta had plenty of baggage. A criminal record, 3 children by 3 different men, and a history of drug use and prostitution. At the scene, her neighbors had told the police that she tried to enter the burning duplex, but the flames were too much. She was covered in blood, had burns on her hands, and was frantic out of her mind. However, once the arson theory was circulated, most of the neighbors backed off. At trial,
Three of them told the jury that she had seemed unconcerned as the fire raged. One was allowed to speculate that she was probably stoned. 7 years later, she spends her days alone in a cell with little human contact. Sex is the currency in a women's prison, but so far the guards have left her alone. She is frail, eats little, reads the Bible and old paperbacks for hours, and speaks in a soft voice. We talk through a screen, so phones are not necessary. She thanks me for coming and asks about Maisie. With four kids, Maisie seldom leaves Savannah, but she has visited here twice and has bonded with Shasta. They swap letters weekly and talk by phone once a month. By now, Maisie knows more about arson than most experts.
"Got a letter from Maisie yesterday," she says with a smile. "Sound like her kids are doing well."
Her kids are doing great.
"I miss my kids, Mr. Post. That's the worst thing of all. I miss my babies."
Today, time is not important. Here they allow the lawyers to stay as long as we want, and Shasta enjoys being out of her cell. We talk about her case, Maisie's children, the weather, the Bible, books, anything that interests her. After an hour, I ask, "Have you read the report?"
"Every word, twice. Sounds like Dr. Musgrove knows his stuff."
Let's hope so. Musgrove is our arson expert, a genuine scientist who has thoroughly debunked the state's investigation. He is of the firm opinion that the fire was not deliberate. In other words, there was no crime at all. But getting his report in the hands of a sympathetic judge will be difficult. Our best shot will be an 11th-hour pardon from the governor, another unlikely scenario. As we talk, I remind myself that this is a case we will probably lose. Of our six current clients, Shasta Briley has the worst chance of survival. We try to talk about Musgrove's report, but the science is often overwhelming, even for me. She drifts back to the latest romance novel she's read, and I happily go along. I am often amazed at how literate some of these inmates become during their incarcerations. A guard reminds me that it's late. We've been chatting for 3 hours. We touch hands at the screen and say goodbye. As always, she thanks me for my time.
Chapter 13. At the time of the Russo murder, Seabrook's police chief was Bruno McNatt, who, according to our research, apparently had little to do with the investigation. In Florida, the county sheriff is the principal law enforcement official and can assume jurisdiction over any crime, even those within municipalities, though in the larger cities, the police departments run things. Russo was murdered inside the city limits of Seabrook, but McNatt was shoved aside by Bradley Fitzner, the longtime sheriff. McNatt was police chief from 1984 through 1990, then moved on to police work in Gainesville. There his career sputtered, and he tried selling real estate. Vicky found him in a low-end retirement village called Sunset Village near Winter Haven. He is 66 and drawing two pensions, one from Social Security, the other from the state. He is married with three adult children scattered around South Florida. Our file on McNatt is thin because he had little to do with the investigation. He did not testify at trial, and his name is barely mentioned. Contacting McNatt is my first real foray into Seabrook. He is not from the town and spent only a few years there. I am assuming he left behind few contacts and had little interest in the murder. I called him the day before I arrived, and he seemed willing to talk. Sunset Village is a series of neat circles of tidy mobile homes around a central community center. Each home has a shade tree beside a concrete driveway, and each vehicle is at least 10 years old. The residents seem eager to escape the confines of their cramped quarters and there is a lot of porch sitting and socializing. Many of the trailers have jerry-rigged ramps for wheelchairs. As I loop around the first circle, I am carefully observed. A few of the old folks offer friendly waves, but most stare at my Ford SUV with Georgia plates, as if noting the intrusion of a trespasser. I park near the community center and watch for a moment as some elderly men slowly go about a game of shuffleboard under a large pavilion. Others are playing checkers, chess, and dominoes. At 66, McNatt is definitely on the younger side of this population. I spot him wearing a blue Braves baseball cap and walk over. We sit at a picnic table near a wall with dozens of posters and bulletins. He's overweight, but seems to be in decent shape. At least he's not on oxygen. He says somewhat defensively,
"I like it here. Lots of good people who take care of each other. No one has any money, so there's no pretense. We try to stay active, and there's plenty to do."
I offer something banal, like it seems to be a nice place. If he's suspicious, he doesn't appear so. He wants to talk and seems proud to have a visitor. I walk him through his career in law enforcement for a few minutes, and he finally gets to the point.
"So, why are you interested in Quincy Miller?"
"He's my client, and I'm trying to get him out of prison."
"Been a long time, hasn't it?"
22 years. "Did you know him?"
"No, not till the murder."
"Were you at the crime scene?"
"Of course I was. Fitzner was already there. Got there pretty fast. And he asked me to take Ms. Russo home. She had found the body, you know, and called 911. Poor lady was a mess, as you might guess. I drove her home and sat with her until some friends came over. It was awful. Then I went back to the scene. Fitzner was in charge, as always, and he was barking orders. I said I thought we should call the state police, which is what we were supposed to do, but Fitzner said he'd do it later."
"Did he?"
"The next day. He took his time. He didn't want anybody else working the case."
"What was your relationship with Fitzner?" I ask. He smiles, but not in a pleasant way.
"I'll be honest with you," he says, as if he has been dishonest so far. "Fitzner got me fired, so I have no use for the man. He'd been the sheriff for 20 years when the town hired me as chief, and he never respected me or any officer in my department. He had an iron grip on the county and didn't want anybody else with a badge trespassing on his turf. That's just the way it was."
"Why did he get you fired?" McNatt grunts and watches the old man play shuffleboard. He finally shrugs and says,
"You got to understand small town politics. I had about a dozen men. Fitzner had twice that. He had a big budget, whatever he wanted, and I got the leftovers. We never got along because he saw me as a threat. He fired a deputy, and when I hired the guy, Fitzner got pissed. All the politicians were afraid of him, and he pulled some strings, got me sacked. I couldn't leave town fast enough." "You been to Seabrook?"
"Not yet."
"You won't find much. Fitzner's been gone for a long time, and I'm sure all his tracks are covered."
It is a loaded statement, as if he wants me to jump in, but I let it slide. This is the first meeting, and I don't want to seem too eager. I have to build trust, and that takes time. Enough of Sheriff Fitzner. I'll circle back in due course. "Did you know Keith Russo?" I ask.
"Sure. I knew all the lawyers. It's a small town."
"What was your opinion of him?"
"Smart, cocky. Not one of my favorites. He roughed up a couple of my men once in a trial, and I didn't like it. Guess he was just doing his job. He wanted to be a big-shot lawyer, and I guess he was on his way. One day we looked up, and he was driving a sleek new black Jaguar, probably the only one in town. Rumor was he settled a big case down in Sarasota and made a killing. He was flashy like that."
"And his wife, Diana?" He shakes his head as if in pain.
Poor lady. I guess I'll always have a soft spot for her. Can you imagine what she went through finding his body like that? She was a mess.
I cannot. Was she a good lawyer?
Well regarded, I guess. I never had dealings with her. A knockout, though. A real beauty.
Did you watch the trial?
No. They moved it next door to Butler County, and I couldn't justify taking time off to sit through a trial.
At the time, did you think Quincy Miller committed the murder?
He shrugs, says, sure. I never had any reason to doubt it. As I recall, there was a pretty strong motive for the killing. Some bad blood. Wasn't there a witness who saw him running away from the scene?
Yes, but she didn't make a positive ID.
Didn't they find the murder weapon in Miller's car?
Not exactly. They found a flashlight with some blood on it.
And the DNA matched, right?
No, there was no DNA testing in 1988. And the flashlight disappeared. He thinks about this for a moment, and it's obvious he doesn't remember the important details. He left Seabrook 2 years after the murder and has tried to forget the place. He says,
I always thought it was an open and shut case. I suppose you think otherwise, right?
I do, or else I wouldn't be here.
So what makes you think Miller's innocent after all these years?
I'm not about to share my theories, not at this point anyway. Maybe later. I reply, the state's case doesn't hold up, I say vaguely. Then move on with, did you maintain any contacts in Seabrook after you left? He shakes his head.
Not really. I wasn't there very long. And as I said, sort of left in a hurry. It was not the highlight of my career.
Did you know a deputy named Kenny Taft?
Sure, knew them all, some better than others. When he got killed, I read about it in the newspapers. I was in Gainesville doing narcotics. I remember his photo. Good guy. Why are you curious about him?
Right now, Mr. McNatt, I'm curious about everything. Kenny Taft was the only black deputy working for Fitzner.
Drug thugs don't care if you're black or white, especially in a gun battle.
You're right about that. Just curious if you knew him. An elderly gent in shorts, black socks, and red sneakers approaches and sets 2 paper cups of lemonade on our table. McNatt says,
well, thank you, Herbie. It's about time.
Herbie snaps, I'll send you the bill, and moves on. We sip our drinks and watch the slow-motion shuffleboard. McNatt asks,
so, if your boy Miller didn't kill Russo, who did?
I have no idea, and will probably never know. My job is to prove Miller didn't do it. He shakes his head and smiles.
Good luck. If somebody else did it, then he's had 20-plus years to run away and hide. Talk about a cold case.
Ice cold, I agree with a smile. But then all of my cases are like this.
And this is all you do? Solve old cases and get people out of prison?
That's it.
How many?
8 in the past 10 years.
And all 8 were innocent?
Yes, as innocent as you and me.
How many times have you found the real killer?
Not all were murders, but in 4 of the cases, we identified the guilty parties.
Well, good luck with this one.
Thanks. I'll need it. I move the conversation to sports. He's a real Gators fan and proud that his basketball team is winning. We touch on the weather, retirement, a bit of politics. McNatt is not the sharpest guy I've met and seems to have little interest in Russo's murder. After an hour, I thank him for his time and ask if I can come back. Certainly, he says, eager to have a visitor. Driving away, I'm struck by the fact that he offered no warning about Seabrook and its shady history. Though he clearly has no affection for Sheriff Fitzner, he did not offer the slightest hint of corruption.
there is more to his story. Chapter 14. 2 months into a slow start, we get our first break. It comes with a phone call from Carrie Holland Pruitt, and she wants to talk. I leave before dawn on a Sunday morning and drive 6 hours to Dalton, Georgia, about halfway between Savannah and Kingsport, Tennessee. The truck stop is just off Interstate 75, and it's one I've been to before. I park with a view of the entrance and wait on Frankie Tatum. We chat on the phone, and 20 minutes later, he parks near me. I watch as he enters the restaurant. Inside, he selects a booth near the rear and orders coffee and a sandwich and opens a newspaper. On the table next to the wall is the usual assortment of condiments and a dispenser with paper napkins. With the newspaper as a shield, he removes the salt and pepper shakers and replaces them with our own versions, cheap stuff from any grocery store. At the bottom of our salt shaker is a recording device. When his sandwich arrives, he sprinkles some salt to make sure there is nothing suspicious. He texts me and says all is well. The place is not that crowded. At 1 p.m., our agreed-upon meeting time, I text Frankie and tell him to eat slow. There is no sign of either Buck's pickup or Carrie Pruitt's Honda. I have their color photos in my file, and I've memorized their Tennessee license plate numbers. At 1:15, I watch the truck slow on the exit ramp and text Frankie. I get out of my SUV, walk into the restaurant, and see Frankie at the counter paying his bill. A waitress is clearing his table, and I ask if it's okay to sit there. Carrie has brought Buck with her, which is a good sign. She's obviously told him her backstory and needs his support. He's a burly guy with thick arms and a graying beard, and I assume wrongly, a short fuse. As soon as they walk in the door, I jump up and wave them over. We make awkward introductions, and I motion to the table. I thank her for the meeting and insist that they order lunch. I'm starving myself and ask for eggs and coffee. They order burgers and fries. Buck stares at me with many doubts. Before I can get to the point, he says, "We checked you out online. Guardian Ministries, you a preacher or a lawyer?" "Both," I say with a winning smile and then ramble a bit about my background. He says proudly, "My daddy was a preacher, you know." "Oh, we know." 4 years ago, his daddy retired after 30 years at a small country church far outside of Bluntville. I feign interest, and we tiptoe around theology light. I suspect Buck strayed from the faith a long time ago. In spite of his rustic appearance, he has a soft voice and a pleasant manner. Carrie says, "For a lot of reasons, Mr. Post, I've never told Buck much about my past." "Please, it's just Post," I say. She smiles, and I'm once again struck by her pretty eyes and strong features. She's wearing makeup and has pulled back her blonde hair, and in a different life, her looks could have opened more promising doors. Buck says, "Okay, first things first. How do we know that we can trust you?" He is asking this of a man who's secretly recording them. Before I can respond, he says, "I mean, Carrie told me what happened back then, what she did, and obviously we're concerned or we wouldn't be here. But this looks like trouble to me." She asks, "What do you really want?" "The truth," I say. "You ain't wearing no wire or anything like that, are you?" Buck asks. I snort at this and raise my hands as if I have nothing to hide. "Come on, I'm not a cop. You want to pat me down? Go ahead." The waitress arrives with more coffee and we clam up. When she's gone, I take the initiative. "No, I'm not wearing a wire. I don't operate like that. What I want is simple.
Ideally, you tell me the truth, then sign an affidavit that I may one day use to help Quincy Miller. I'm also talking to the other witnesses and trying to get the same thing, the truth. I know that much of the testimony at trial was fabricated by the cops and prosecutor, and I'm just trying to piece it all together. Your statement will certainly help, but it's just one part of the big picture. What's an affidavit? Buck asks. Just a sworn statement under oath. I'll prepare it and you guys review it. Then I'll keep it under wraps until it's needed. No one around Kingsport will ever know. Seabrook is too far away.
Do I have to go to a courtroom? She asks.
Unlikely. Let's assume I can convince a judge that Quincy did not get a fair trial. That, frankly, is a long shot. But if it happens, then there is the remote possibility that the prosecutor will decide to try him again for the murder. That could be years down the road. If so, you could be called as a witness, which is quite unlikely because you did not see a black man running from the scene, right? She doesn't nod or say anything for a moment. Our plates arrive and we prepare our food. Buck likes ketchup. Neither wants salt or pepper. I sprinkle salt on my eggs and place the shaker in the center of the table. Carrie nibbles on a French fry and avoids eye contact. Buck chomps on his burger. They obviously talked about the situation at length without making a decision. She needs prodding, and I ask, "Who convinced you to testify?" "Sheriff Fitzner?" She says,
"Look, Mr. Post, I'll talk to you and tell you what happened, but I'm not sold on the idea of getting involved. I'm going to think long and hard before I sign any affidavit."
"You can't repeat what she says, can you?" Buck asks as he wipes his mouth with a paper napkin. "I can't repeat it in court, if that's what you're asking. I can talk to my staff about it, but that's as far as I can go. Any judge will require an affidavit from a witness."
"I'm worried about my boys," she says. "They don't know. I'd be ashamed if they found out their mother lied in court and sent a man to prison."
I reply, "I understand that, Carrie, and you should be concerned. But there's also the likelihood that they will be proud of the fact that you came forward to help free an innocent man. We all did bad things when we were 20, but some mistakes can be corrected. You're worried about your boys? Think about Quincy Miller. He has 3 kids he hasn't seen in 22 years, and 5 grandchildren he's never seen, not even in a photograph." They absorb this and stop eating for a moment. They are overwhelmed and frightened, but the wheels are turning. I say, "We have the records, and they tell us that your drug charge was dismissed a few months after the trial. Fitzner convinced you to take the stand, tell your story, and the prosecutor promised to lose the drug charge, right?" She breathes deeply and looks at Buck, who shrugs and says, "Go ahead. We didn't drive 5 hours for cheeseburgers." She tries to drink from her coffee cup, but her hands are shaking. She puts it down and shoves her plate a few inches away. Staring straight ahead, she says,
"I was dating a deputy named Lonnie. We were doing drugs, lots of drugs. I got caught, but he kept me out of jail. Then the lawyer got murdered, and a few weeks later, Lonnie told me he had things worked out. If I would claim that I saw a black man running away from the lawyer's office, then the drug charge would get dismissed. Just like that. So he took me down to Fitzner's office, and I told my story. The next day, Lonnie and Fitzner took me to see the prosecutor. Can't remember his name."
"Burkhead. Forrest Burkhead."
"That's him.